How do you perceive the role of the employee constituency groups, civil service, administrative professionals, faculty senate, graduate council, etc., in policy development and implementation and decision making?
I think the composition of this search committee and the manner in which the search was conducted says a lot about the culture of constituency input on this campus. This is not the norm for a lot of searches. And I think a person has to pay attention to what that committee reflects, and that is that there are many groups on this campus, they're involved, and they need to be involved. So how do I perceive that in terms of decision making? I think anybody who would come into this position, and this is a statement you probably heard before, it needs to hit the ground listening and learning, finding out what the issues are, involving people in meaningful ways. And the obvious things you do, I'm sure there's analogs from this, but there would be something like the Chancellor's Executive Council, the Chancellor's Council that would involve different constituencies. You should meet with the leadership Senate on a regular basis. I do that every month. I go to every Senate meeting. The Student Government Association, or the analog here. But also, you can involve faculty, staff, and students in so many other ways. I mentioned that when we launched the Student Retention Initiative, it was a very large committee, maybe too large, 25, 28 people, consisting of all representatives on campus. Every fall, we reconvene a new committee of students, faculty, and staff to review our strategic plan. We revise our key strategies and our key challenges, and that comes from their input. Whenever we have a committee, like right now we're doing a committee search, we're doing a search for a new dean of architecture. That committee includes staff, students, faculty, members from the community. And so there are many different ways you can bring these groups into these discussions, and you need to make sure you do it in a way that's meaningful, where they have their own input. It's not just a gratuitous gesture. But it's essential for a university to have input from all those constituents. Let me just say what I would do. I were on this campus. The first year, I would go to every college. I'd meet with the leadership of that college. I would take a tour of the facility. I would then meet with the faculty and the students. I would go to every department. And I said, I'm going to be there for 1 hour, the coffee lounge. I want you to come by and you tell me what I should know. Tell me things that are important for me to do my job. Give me bragging points that I can take out there to tell your story. I don't want that to be a complaining session. I want it to be something about positive. So communication is so
essential. In terms of ensuring student voices are heard, what steps have you taken at your current or former institutions to have students' views taken into consideration as part of the campus decision-making process?
Well, I've mentioned some of those already. We include students on important, every dean search has a student. I do meet with the Student Government Leadership Association, but not as regularly as I do the faculty. We have a process where the students determine the fee structure. It's all vetted through the students. They make those decisions, they make those recommendations. So those are kind of the more formal ways of getting some input. But I think you have to realize that when you talk to the leadership of maybe even of the Faculty Senate or the Student Government Association, you're not hearing everybody's point of view. Sometimes the only way you learn what's on their mind is when you go out and interact with them in departments, at events. I think students would say that I love to talk. They probably try to get away from me sometimes. But you have to take advantage of every opportunity you can to hear what's ways formally, in some ways just through anecdotal information.
Well, turning to financial matters, funding reductions from the state and other budget reductions have cut many functions here at SIU to the core. Fewer and fewer people are performing more and more tasks essential to the operation of their units. The prospect of future reductions would almost certainly spell disaster for many of these units. How would you lead the university through the process of additional budget adjustments that require a prioritization of needs and services while ensuring the university continues to provide a quality education for our students?
Well, so first, I think you have to lay the facts out accurately and without undue alarm. So I've read that they're proposing 31.5, but I heard it might be more like 5 to 10. And then if you look at your budget, about 25% of your budget is state appropriations, 25% is tuition, and then the rest is through auxiliaries and restricted resources. So if you have a 5 or 10% cut, it's not quite as draconian as it may sound when you read that. And you need to convey that because that's demoralizing. And so you first kind of control the tone of that conversation. But then I think what you have to do, and we're past the point of making superficial, you have to really look at your mission, what it is you do well, and you have to market your university in a way that emphasizes your strengths. Why do students come here? How are you going to grow enrollment? And then I think you need to have a lot of input in reviewing the strategies you may employ. There should be a group of faculty that are going through the budget process. I know you're already doing these things. There should be a review of your academic programs, a review of your services. I would prefer to call it a review, not a prioritization. First you see what the situation is, then you begin to prioritize. And that's after much input. But also I think you have to be very proactive in how you are going to respond. You know, nationally, everybody knows this, state appropriations are dropping. And the gap has been filled by tuition. Nationally right now, across the United States, about 45 to 50% of operating budgets come from tuition. And we've kind of maybe reached the max of where we can continue to grow enrollment. So you have to look for ways to provide net new revenue. You have to be innovative. International is something you're doing here. Online offers some opportunities. I think you have to look at the adult student population. I read recently there was a report by the Education Advisory Board. There are more than 50 million adults in this country that have some college education. They did a survey that more than half want to go back and get a degree. Very few do. How do you reach them? Online plays a role in that. And I think you have to look for niche programs. There's potential for growth, especially in certain master's and certificate programs. And you have strong opportunities here in terms of your connections to medicine and business and engineering, where there's a lot of those professional master's programs that are driven by employer interest. And when you say you're cutting the services down to the core, that's an issue. I looked at your count of faculty. I think all full and part-time is down about 10%. But that's close to your drop in enrollment over the past 5 years. It's been about 11%. But what was alarming was the decrease in your tenured and tenure track lines. That's down the last 5 years by about 20-22%, I recall. That's so important to growing the research capacity of the university and its prestige. So that's something that you have to really make sure that you look elsewhere before you reduce lines. If it makes you feel any better, I look to see how much they've reduced administrative appointments. It's down 27 or 28. So there's been some balance there. And if that's the way you need to, when we went through cuts at Tech in 2009 and 10, we had 5% give back when you got 5% less than next. We had a university-wide committee. We kind of decided what we wanted to do, and we protected the academic core. We took it out of services, centers, and things like that, with auxiliaries and such. And most universities employ something like that. You have to protect your core mission.
What are your thoughts and experiences regarding securing external grant funding and raising private donations to support colleges, departments, and other units of campus that have already seen significant reductions to their state appropriations?
Yeah, that's crucial. You know, I mentioned that you have your state appropriations and you have your tuition. And where do you really have some flexibility? In those restricted dollars that come from grants and gifts and philanthropic activity. Now, the issue there is, in this time of sequestration, federal funding has become very competitive. It was always competitive, now it's even more. You have to make sure you have a culture that supports faculty success. Teaching load is an issue. But your Office of Research Services, or your Office of Accounting Research, or whatever you call it here, SPAR, are they providing sufficient pre- and post-grant support? Are you providing sort of stimulus programs within the college to seed those efforts? Most people do. We have something called the Academic Stimulus Program. It's primarily to give grants to people in the humanities and social sciences. When I was interim president, we did this for 1 year, and then once I was out of that office, they didn't continue it. I started a bridge program. Because a lot of times the people who are left out are those in the sciences who are between funding, and they have to sustain their labs, and they have to get data. So we provided a program for people who had grants in the offing to bridge that period. You have to be going to the agencies. You have to be visible there. I think having rotating program directorships is important. Promoting interdisciplinary activity is also very important. Going after large grant programs. So much of the day's funding is in big joint efforts. And you have to be a player in that, and that takes effort. So in terms of philanthropic, the role of the deans there is so essential. That's where most of the fundraising takes place. A couple of years ago, we concluded a $1 billion campaign at Texas Tech. That was for the system. But we've grown our endowment at the university to about $600 million. That's fairly significant. When I was dean in 4 years, if you look at the report from the foundation report, it would say I raised $55 million. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to mention that some of that was gift in kind. We have some wealthy oil companies in Texas. But nevertheless, fundraising, in my opinion, is fun. You go out and you see people who are the best examples of what your university has produced. They invigorate you about your task. I always told faculty, I'd love to take you on those trips. You might behave differently when you're teaching college algebra. If you knew that guy in the back row, somebody was going to give $1 million. It's a great way to advocate for the university, to take the message of the university out there, and it takes time to cultivate those relationships, but it's something that's very important for the chancellor in concert with the deans and the faculty when it's appropriate. That's so important today. I looked up your giving rate. Of course, it was in U.S. News and World Report. You can always question exactly how accurate that is, but it's about 5 or 6%. That's low. You have about 200,000 alums. That's the same number we have. Of course, your institution's a lot older. You have a large alumni base. And if you give people a chance, and you give them something to brag about, they want to support the university. It's a big cause.
You've mentioned terms like strategic plan and mission, and you've spoken to a few of these aspects, but can you elaborate a little bit more for us on your general process for creating a realistic long-term vision for a campus like SIU?
Okay, I've looked at your strategic plan, and it has a lot of good things in it. One of the first things I noticed, I counted 13 goals. That's a lot. So here's the strategy we use. Every year we revise it. We have five. Again, I hope I don't sound like I'm always going to make reference to where I am. I think when a person goes to a new school, you need to stop that. That's my only point of reference at this moment. We have five strategic priorities. Most of the people know them because we've been harping on these for years. Grow enrollment, enhance student success, increase academic reputation and quality, enhance research and creative activity, enhance, expand outreach and engagement, and maximize resources. That's it. And then every year we have a committee of faculty, students, the president of the SGA is on that, and staff, and we review the key strategies and key challenges. And every year that list gets shorter and shorter because we realize we have to put something there that's implementable and meaningful. It can't be everybody's wish list. But with each of those priorities, we have a table of benchmarks that we monitor. We decide what should we be looking at. Like last year, under research and creative activity, we felt like we were not representing all the activity in the humanities and social sciences. So we started tracking performances, publications, and shows and things like that. It gives you a sense of how you're progressing towards your goals, and then we revise our targets. You make it a dynamic living document. And then you have to put money behind it. What we do at TAC, I started this last year, I started what we call budget hearings. The deans come in, they get about 15, 20 minutes to tell us the good things they're doing, and then we get into their needs. And we ask them to align their requests with our priorities so they know what they are. And then we take that, we go to the president, me and the CFO, and we distribute new resources. Align with the priorities and their requests. We did it again this year, but this year we asked the deans to bring all their leadership. Brought in chairs and such. And we go then out to the colleges and have these college forums. I go to every college, and then I'll go to units like the museum and such. We've done 14 of those. I think I have two more to go. I was just in business the other day. We show them university budget, we show them information about the state, we show them their budget, and then we show them where we may, what drives our decisions. We look at the metrics. Enrollment, retention, things like that, and how we align our investment with their needs and the priorities. And it's really been interesting. The first year we did this, the deans came forward, and after you threw out the ridiculous stuff, they made requests for $33 million in new funding. They had no concept that money, we just stopped printing it. And we gave out $13 million in new money. This year, the requests are $20. They understand that they have to make meaningful suggestions. And we don't know what our budget yet because we're still in session. I've kind of rambled on there, but those are things we do that align our investments with our strategic plan, make it real.
What steps will you take to foster cooperation between campus units in order to eliminate the silo effect? A mentality that exists within these units that are competing for resources that are becoming more and more limited. And do you have any specific examples of where you've gotten units to work together?
Yeah. You know, everybody understands the importance of multidisciplinary research. Making it happen is another thing. There's a cultural issues there. When you go into a department, you hire somebody in the field, they have to publish in that field because they're being evaluated by the experts there. So it's difficult to get people to go out of that framework. So what are things you can do? Well, 2 years ago, we started a cluster hiring initiative. We put about $10, $11 million in it. We picked the areas of food safety, genomics, soft materials, and cybersecurity. And typically, two or three lines went with every area. There'd be faculty member was the key point of contact. And they had to make sure that those three hires crossed departmental boundaries. It's not easy. And the verdict is still out about how successful we are, will be. But other things you do, if you have centers, how do you deal with the distribution of F&A? This is something people fight over. If you route a grant through a center as opposed to your department, who gets the F&A? You have to be very flexible in how you distribute those indirect costs to encourage that behavior. When faculty want to collaborate, will their chair hold it against them if they're over there working in a different unit? You have to change the culture by which faculty are rewarded for that kind of activity. And people that are very important in that are the chairs working with the deans. That's where the rubber really hits the road. and then you have to support it. When those dossiers come forward and somebody has published in an area that's maybe outside their discipline, your colleagues may not have appreciated it. You have to make sure you pay attention to that.
What do you see as the chancellor's role in boosting employee morale in an era of economic and financial uncertainty for the university, which includes concerns about job security and reduced benefits?
Well, you have to tell it like it is, but you also need to be totally transparent. You have to have enough knowledge of detail that you could be involved in the strategic planning and make sure you have a coherent plan, and then you can articulate it to the community. And I think you have to demonstrate that you're out there looking for new sources. You just don't sit back and take it. That means you're going down to the legislature, you're working with the president to make your case. You have to be an advocate for the university. In fact, you need to know that you're accessible, that you're listening to them. And you know, so some of this is cheerleading, but also it needs to be real substantive actions behind this. I do enjoy being involved in strategic planning and budgetary information. You have to defer to control at college levels eventually. But I think when you communicate to the deans, getting their input is so essential, and they from their chairs, and you work together. You don't make those decisions in isolation. There are certain things I would never do. I would never sweep funds. I would never dig into somebody's accounts. You just don't do things like that. And as for the benefits with the Health Care Act, that's complicated, especially for graduate students. They're squeezed by this in terms of how many hours they can work. And you have to be very innovative. It's not all settled.
What do you think the key to student success is at a university such as SIU, Carbondale, and how would you personally contribute to that success?
Well, it starts with the relationship between the teacher and the student in the classroom. The personal relationship you have with your students has a profound effect on their experience. And that's one thing that's come through loud and clear. The faculty here like their students. That statement I read from Sam says that. And so that is the most important. You have good teachers in front of the students. But then you have to be very proactive in terms of advising. So we're involved in this intensive advising process. We have these dashboards that inform a student when they might be at risk. Early intervention, make sure that if some courses are identified as problematic, you have adequate supplemental instruction. That courses that are bottlenecks in terms of progress through degree are open, they can get in those courses. Typically, you can identify one or two courses that are real indicators of success or failure, and you have to address those. For us, it's English 1301. And for other schools, it's something else. But that's what we learned from the EAB, Student Success Collaborative. Another thing that we learned when they went through 10 years was the data that if our students could complete 30 hours in 1 year, their graduation rate was 89%. So what does that say? Well, they probably came in there with an idea of what they wanted to do in proper backgrounds. They didn't have to work. But if you could create an environment where students can complete in 12 to 15 hours, that's not only important for the budget, but it's important for student success. There are so many aspects of student success. Your co-curricular activities, the learning environments you have in dorms, you can do so much. I'm sure your division of student affairs or undergraduate education does a lot. You have to do that. If you're going to be competitive, you have to be giving them all that support. And it's different today from what it was years ago. It's very hands-on.
You talk about enrollment every
retention, and that's a big issue here at the university. A number of initiatives have been undertaken to improve that. And as you noted, maybe we're on the right track now. How are we going to further that? How are we going to increase that?
Are they having a hard time hearing me back there? Oh, I apologize for that. That's terrible. Darn it. okay, let's do that. You have to be working closely with the undergrad admissions, student enrollment and management. For us, what we found at Texas Tech, because of our geographical isolation, we need to have a lot of recruiters out there in the state. We have over 20 scattered around the state. They have to make contact with those students. They need to associate a face with the university. You just can't do it through online and printed materials. You then go to them through these brochures and such. And then you get them on campus. Once we get them on campus, we feel like we can keep them. So you have to have a very strategic and focused marketing and recruiting strategy. It can be done without money. I don't think you need to bring Noel Levinson here to do a study. That's what we did, and it was useful. But you can do a lot of this just at a grassroots level. But it's very competitive. You have to look at student populations that represent opportunities. The distance from Chicago to here is about the same as the distance from Lubbock to Dallas. And that's where we have most of our students. I noticed that you have more students from Cook County than any other place. I don't understand why you don't have more students from St. Louis. I asked the president, is there a gentleman's agreement that you don't compete against SIU at Edwardsville? He said no. I don't know all of the nuances of these areas. I would have to be educated about them. But you need to go where the students are. And everybody's going to Texas. A lot of states have recruiting offices there. And you do get some from there, but you have to be very proactive. Have recruiters placed around the country as well as around the state, as well as your marketing campaign. You have to send a relevant message. Those students, we use Snapchat. We start using Snapchat to connect to students. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but they've got a 30-second attention span. You have to be in tune with what these kids are doing, and I'm not. I remember the Super Bowl this year, there was this person performing, and I asked my son, who is that person? I've never seen her. His dad just out of it. But you have people who are not out of it, and you have to use them.
I had noticed that you had set in on a large number of graduate and doctoral awards. Can you describe some of your experience in working with doctoral students and programs, and in doing so, how vital do you feel they are to the university like SIU Carbondale? And in your answer, please address your thoughts on the importance of funding for graduate students at all levels.
Graduate students are essential to the research and scholarly enterprise at the university. In a lot of ways, your reputation is influenced by those graduate students that you place at other institutions. And that's so important. It's a challenge nationally, graduate enrollment. I haven't seen the figures for 14, but I looked at the graduate council from 8 to 13. And at Publix, the increase was less than 1% a year. So it's competitive. Again, international students are an option. Now, in my own experience, working with graduate students is one of the most satisfying things about being a faculty member. I think we all feel that way. You mentor them, they become a friend for life. So that relationship is very important in terms of support. It surprised me to learn that at our institution, only about 30% of our students get some support. We have 5,800 graduate students. And then I looked around and I saw, like, for the Association of American Universities, it's only 40%. So a lot of students are going to go and not get support. So where are they going to go? They're going to go where you have good programs. And you have a lot of good programs. I mentioned you have 15 ranked in U.S. News and World Report. Those reputations matter. People look at the NRC rankings, National Research Council. That's very important for some areas, that you have programs that are there. Support, grant dollars are an important source of support, but institutional support has to be there. I was surprised to learn that from the report I saw for the AAU schools, they provide more institutional support than grant support. So you just can't say, go out and get a grant. You have to have the money there. That's how you're going to grow enrollment. And I did notice that your graduate teaching assistant count was fairly constant. So you protected that, and that needs to be done. Again, it's a matter of finding resources. Endowments are important. We have a $50 million endowment in the graduate school for graduate support. So that pays out, that pays out a lot of money, about 4.5% a year. Growing endowment support for graduate students is important. Other things you need to do is the support mechanisms in place. We just opened, we had a ribbon cutting about a month ago, a new graduate center. Students go there to get support. There's a writing center in there that helps, especially our international students with writing issues, and thesis and doctoral dissertations. There's a stat center there to help them do statistical analysis. It's a place where they can meet with other students, builds a sense of community. So besides the money, besides that kind of support, you have to provide for their professional development. And those things sometimes will compensate for the level of the stipend. But ultimately, many students, when they're not that informed, are going to just compare the stipend. And so that's something that just has to be dealt with. It doesn't mean you solve it overnight. I don't know what the levels are here, but I'm sure with the challenges of your budget, that's not an easy matter to deal with.
Like all universities, SIU has a unique relationship with the city of Carbondale and the broader region. Can you speak to strategies you may have used in the past that you might consider employing here to enhance the relationship that SIU has with the city and the region?
Yeah, that's so important. I understand that there's a close connection between the city and SIU. That's the message I've received, and that's essential. Now, interaction with the community takes place in many different ways. There's economic development, but there are other matters in terms of cultural enrichment. You have events on campus that bring people out of the community, and we do a lot of that. We have a president's lecture series. We have the College of Visual and Performing Arts is so essential to enriching the cultural climate of the community. But we also, you can engage them through academic programs in the departments. When I was a chair of math, I read an article one day, what is an outreach mathematician? It was in the Notice of the American Math Society. And I decided we need one of those here. So I went out and hired one. He was at the University of Tennessee. And it was controversial because my colleagues said, this is not mathematics. This is, you're dealing with social problems. But a few years later, we actually got a statewide award. I went out to the Senate for some kind of community engagement. We started programs with middle school female students to get them involved in mathematics and a bunch of things like that. You do a lot of things like that here, I realize. But there are more substantial things you can do. A few years ago in 2012-13, we received one of seven Promise Neighborhood grants from the Department of Education. It was $24.5 million. It was coordinated through several colleges. The College of Education took the lead. Visual Performing Arts was in there, Arts and Sciences, Engineering. We partnered with hospitals, with the food bank, grocery stores, And it was a program not only to affect the educational programs in certain middle schools in a very poor part of town in a high school, but we provided, we got clinics to stay open after 5 o'clock. Weekend programs to affect social well-being, health, and safety. And it's been had an amazing impact on the community. It just sends a strong signal that you're dedicated to that community. We provided free tuition for students at a high school, and we paid the salaries for those teachers that would deliver dual credit. And now, that's going to grow into plans to start an early college high school there. And it's not a money-making proposition, but it helps create a pipeline for those students, especially those that wouldn't necessarily come to the university. So you can engage the community, those kind of educational programs, the social programs, but I do think the chancellor has to take advantage of every opportunity he or she has to go out there and meet with the Rotary, Lions Club, whatever you go. And in terms of economic development, you know, you have an entity here similar to what we do. It's called the InterTech Innovation Hub. It's meant to promote connections with industry, spawn new entrepreneurial activity. But I think you have to keep in mind that economic activity takes to, it reveals itself in different ways. You know, we can say at Texas Tech where our economic impact statewide is $6.4 billion. That's what the study shows. That doesn't mean much to people. What it does show up to them is how it affects their community. Are you interacting with the K-12 school systems to make them attractive for potential employers who would come in? Are you providing the cultural amenities and enrichments that make this a desirable place to live in? Those are other ways you can impact economic development.
So now we're to the easy question. Would you tell us something about yourself that you feel provides you a unique advantage to your ability to succeed as chancellor of SIU Carbondale?
Well, I'm a quick learner. I would come to grips very rapidly with a baseline understanding of the university. And I think, and I'm sure everybody would do this, but when you come to an institution, you need to take advantage of the cultural history there, the foundation. You don't start from scratch. And you make sure that you don't marginalize anybody. You take full advantage of all the human capital. I would do that. I'm a pretty enthusiastic guy. And I think people would understand early on that that it was a passion, and that goes a long ways in cultivating success.